Why, hello there, you. Before you get on and listen to this latest episode, I want to ask you a question. Do you have enough Myrtleade in your life? If the answer is no, did you know that you can get exclusive access to 2 whole previous seasons, dozens of exclusive episodes, and a catalogue of minisodes? All you have to do is head on over to patreon.com/Myrtleade, spelt Myrtleade, and join our Patreon family. For as little as $5 a month, you get more Myrtleade than your strange mind can handle. The more you pledge, the more you get. Seriously, guys, that is like a single cup of coffee per month, and you help support me as a creator, and you help keep this podcast an ad-free zone. Because, you know, there has to be one space in our lives that's ad-free. Okay. On with today's offering. Strange ones, and welcome back to this here train wreck that I like to call Myrtleade. As always, I'm your host Anne, and I want to share that tonight's drink is a blood orange martini, and that I'm completely obsessed with citrus season. This is part 2 of the Easy Street Murders, so if you haven't listened to last week's episode, this will make no fucking sense to you, so have at that one first. This is also the conclusion of not only this case, but of the season. So I can't even believe that. It's surreal to me. Nearly 50 episodes in and you're still listening. What's wrong with you? Ask yourself some deep questions. So we'll be going on a break for a few weeks while I pull my shit together and organize stories for season 3. That's exciting, right? But if you miss me, there is always Patreon. Weekly Patreon episodes will continue over the break. Seamless segue, hey. Shout out to Ray and Aaron VR. Look, honestly, because your name is bloody unpronounceable, I'm not even going to attempt it. And I'm sure you will forgive me because, I mean, you know it's unpronounceable, right? Thanks for being the newest members of the Patreon family. If you yourself find you just don't get enough Myrtleade in your life, the solution is simple. Go to www.patreon.com/Myrtleade and you will get more content than your mind will know what to do with. You can pledge as much or as little as you like, get varying degrees of content, free merch according to the tier that you choose. Yes, merch issue. It is sorted if you go to myrtleade.com. And order merch. The website is all fixed. I'm sorry, I'm fucking terrible at technology. But if you want a bargain, this week only we are running a package sale exclusive for our Facebook followers. So go and check us out on facebook.com/Myrtleade the podcast. And you'll find a post advertising the super special where if you buy 100% organic cotton tee, you get the second design of shirt and a lapel pin for only $15 extra. Email me at myrtleade@gmail.com if you're outside Australia and I'll calculate shipping and we'll invoice you. That's enough of the business of murder. Let's get down to the murder business. This podcast contains graphic depictions of violence, salty language and poor grammar. If at any time these things offend you, feel free to fuck off and listen to a podcast about milking your yak. Our old mate, Wikipedia, Murderpedia, The Independent, 2 articles by Tess Lawrence, one in 2017 and one in 2019, and Tess's original piece on the crime from the 21st of January 1977 from the now defunct Melbourne Herald, the ABC News article by Loretta Florence, the National Library of Australia Crime History Collection, an article from The Age by Patrick Murphy in 2003, the fabulous and intriguing book Murder on Easy Street by Helen Thomas, a book by Tom Pryor called They Trusted Men, The Untold Story of the Easy Street Murders, and, as always, the bizarre shit I've stored for years right in the back of my brain. When we left off, we had two dead women and a baby left alone for days in a seemingly sexually motivated crime. There was a shit ton of stabbing and necrophilia. What more can you ask for? We are going to leave Easy Street for just a minute, actually for most of this episode, and we're going to travel back in time and then forward to three seemingly unrelated murders, but in my opinion, totally related murders. In the June of 1975, a 19-year-old librarian and Californian native, Julie Ann Garcia Soleil, met John Grant in her job where she worked at the Southdown Press, which is basically a library, on Latrobe Street in Melbourne. So when she met him, John Grant was at the time in the company of a well-known boxer and part-time thug, Reese Tommy Collins. John Grant, by the way, is a crime reporter. He's a reporter of all kinds of things. But he was working at a newspaper, and he says that he met Tommy Collins through his beat work on the beat, you know, pretend cop work, I think. And John Grant also states, and I'd like to put this here at the beginning, that people like me who connect him publicly to these murders have ruined his life. Well, suck it up, princess. You lay with dogs, you are going to get fleas. The two men apparently approached the bubbly new Australian, Julianne, with the idea of opening an American-style soul food restaurant in Melbourne. They wanted her input. Julianne was struggling to fit in and she was trying to make new friends in Australia, and she kind of warmed to the pair. So she invited them to her place, a little unit that she shared with her sister Gail, on Canning Street in North Melbourne. This gathering happened on Wednesday, the 1st of July 1975. This gathering is also the last known sighting of Julie Ann Garcia Soleil. So I need to also say here that a lot of reports just report Julie as Julie Garcia, but her name is actually Julie Ann Garcia Soleil. So as one word, I want to add that Julie Ann looks remarkably like one of our Susans. Susan Armstrong, one of the women who was murdered a year later on Easy Street in Collingwood. In their homes are roughly a 10-minute drive from each other. Julianne has long, dark, straight hair, worn parted at the side and long over her shoulders. She has an elongated, pretty face and arch-shaped eyebrows. She is slim and attractive. John and Tommy Collins went over to Julianne's flat to have a drink and discuss this possible business venture. You can't see me doing the air quotes when I say business venture. But I trust me, I'm doing them. So John worked for one of the publications that Julie's library serviced, and Tommy was at the time the Australian middleweight boxing champion, come illegal two-up operator, and at that time he was also involved in several other low-level criminal enterprises. They claim they met Julie Ann when researching police corruption in the library, and I did find a document where one of the men involved in this story is mentioned in an anti-corruption inquest, that he had placed several written complaints about what he perceived to be corruption within the Victorian police force. So Julie was home alone on the night of the 1st. Her sister Gail was out until the next day. Now, Gail had left Julianne some change and a phone number of her work scribbled on a piece of paper, because they had this plan where Julianne was going to ring in a sickie for her sister and Gail was spending the night with a friend in nearby Kew. They had no phone in the apartment, so Julianne was meant to make that call at the payphone down the street. Yes, Gen Wise, that is a little box with a phone with a roundy thing with numbers on it. John and Tommy did not arrive alone. They brought a friend, John Joseph Powers. Powers had not previously known Julianne. The three claim that Julianne left the apartment at around 10 to 10:30 p.m. to make the phone call to her sister's boss, and that she never returned. They got tired of waiting for her, so they simply left. Easy as that, right? Except she is never seen again. Her sister Gail returned home the next day to find a blood-soaked towel and her sister's underwear cut and thrown on the floor of the apartment. She also found the money she had left for the phone call and the piece of paper with her work number written on it, sitting exactly where she had left it. Like Julianne had never picked it up and gone to make the phone call. She rang police and the search for Julianne began. It was discovered that Julianne actually never made that phone call to her sister's work. I think it's most likely that she never left her apartment alive. Missing from the apartment was $125 in cash, which in 1975 is a substantial amount. There was also a carving knife missing from the kitchen and a floor-length black velvet cape, which was amongst Julie's possessions, was not there. Nothing suspicious at all. Now you want me to say all she had was the clothing on her back. Actually, the clothing on her back was no longer on her back. So Julianne's keys, handbag, and wallet were in the apartment. The clothes she'd been wearing that day were on the floor in the kitchen, which was a pair of jeans and a shirt. Her belt was cut and found in the bedroom. A bloody towel was on Julianne's bed. There were bloodstains on the floor of the apartment landing. Everything at the scene pointed towards a sexual assault and murder. And there were three men, virtual strangers, in her apartment alone with her that night. Over the years, this case has been reinvestigated to the same outcome. None. To the same suspects. John Grant, Tommy Collins, and John Joseph Power. All three stuck to their claims that Julianne left to make a phone call and never returned. In 2018, the coroner ruled that Julianne Garcia-Soleil was dead and most likely murdered on the 1st of July 1975, which was really sadly a mere 9 days before her 20th birthday. Now, a crime reporter and a boxer is one thing, but when you add John Joseph Power, it's a whole different thing. Let's talk about this asshole for just a minute. 3 years before Julianne Garcia-Soleil went missing, John Joseph Power found himself defending in court, facing murder charges for the death of another young woman in Melbourne. The state felt it had enough evidence to convict John Power, so they went forwards with a trial. The career criminal had a great lawyer, and he found himself acquitted by the jury and continued along his merry way. He was then indicated as a suspect in Julianne's presumed murder. Fast forward, and he's being jailed for the perpetration of a shooting. Yeah, nice guy. And then a string of armed robberies. Come 1992, he is in court again. This time he is convicted of the vicious rape and beating of a 19-year-old girl. He receives a 30-year sentence, but just because our version of justice is shit, he doesn't serve anywhere near that long. He also escaped prison twice and was brought back. Power was out on parole in 2002, you know, like 10 years after he received that 30-year sentence. Ugh. When he attacked a sex worker in his Broadview Housing Commission unit. So a housing commission unit, for those of you outside Australia, is discount housing provided by the government for people who have like disabilities or they're on long-term unemployment or they're like single moms and they're having trouble affording housing. So while in his home, Power grabbed this woman and held a knife to her throat. He attempted to gag her and threatened to kill her with the knife. Does that sound familiar to anyone? The poor woman managed to escape the old man's clutches and sought shelter at his neighbour's house while awaiting police. I suppose being a lifelong criminal comes with the advantage of knowing some revolting and slimy lawyers. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against lawyers. I know some who are honourable and do really great work. These are not the people that John Powers knows. John Powers knows bad people. He had access to the other kind of lawyer. The let's get this lifelong rapist and thrice accused murderer off of everything. Forever. Okay, we're set for that. Proceed, Counsellor. Well, Your Honour, my client, the upstanding piece of shit standing before you, shouldn't have to answer to any of these charges of basically taking a woman hostage with a knife or being questioned about the other two women he's accused of murdering, merely coincidentally, with a knife, because he's old. Look at the dear old man, sweating in his dirty, threadbare wife beater, rubbing his junk. He's simply too feeble of body and mind to ever talk to the police again. So we're all on the same page, right, Your Honour? Great. So there's a bit of artistic license there, but you get my point. Some piece of shit lawyer actually succeeded in arguing in 2002 that John Joseph Power, who had only months before been capable of hiring a sex worker, then physically attacking and restraining her against her will, he's now so dottery in the mind and enfeebled in the body, he couldn't possibly even be questioned by police. And it worked. It was also claimed that he had mere months to live because he was dying of a heart condition. Any further questioning about Julie Ann Garcia Soleil would possibly kill him. So the court order was placed that would prevent police from further questioning John Joseph Power on any of these matters or any other matter. The slimy old bastard died in his bed at 71, a decade after this injunction was placed, in 2012, like a kingpin. I hope the motherfucker rots in hell. The boxer, Reese Tommy Collins, had started his career as a fairground attraction and actually worked his way up to being the Australian middleweight champion. He had several criminal enterprises, mainly low-level gambling, but he died in 1998. He maintained until his death that Julie Ann had left the apartment to make a phone call and never returned. The crime reporter John Grant is where I probably rest a little bit of focus. Let's all put our thinking caps on for a minute. Why am I telling you about these assholes when I'm supposed to be telling you who killed Suzanne and Susan in Easy Street in 1977? Because guess who lived right next door to the Sues on Easy Street? The ever-present link in this chain. Journalist John Grant. On the evening of the 10th of January, the night the Sues were murdered, John Grant was next door having drinks and a suspicious adult male sleepover with two friends. If you're wondering why I'm a bit of a bitch about this guy, it's summed up in the one quote that he gave to The Age regarding the murders of the Sues and Julianne, quote, "I would like to see the whole thing solved too, of course, and get some peace for me, for everybody." Don't you love how he just adds the "for everybody" afterwards? Like, his life is the most affected by this? Narcissist. Excuse me. And I promised you three murders I believe may have been linked to those on Easy Street. So if my arithmetic is correct, we have the murder of an unnamed woman, allegedly by Power, who he was, you know, not convicted of in 1972. And then the disappearance of Julianne. But that's only two. Let's talk about Jenny. Jenny Rose Ng was recently separated single mum. She was living on Elizabeth Street in Richmond in Melbourne in 1982. On the morning of the 23rd of April, Jenny Rose, she got her eldest three children ready for school and started packing school lunches. She saw them off and they walked down the street to school and fed her 11-month-old baby and started to go about her daily routine. At about 10:30, Jenny let an unidentified man into her apartment. Neighbours heard him speaking to her at the door. So she was in like a high-rise building and had neighbours on either side. She lived on the 16th floor. When the children came home for lunch at 12:30, they discovered their mother had been brutally stabbed to death. This is the eerie thing to keep in mind. Police think that Suzanne let her killer in willingly too. Their homes are, again, about 10 minutes away from each other. No one heard anything, and the baby? She was found in her cot in the next room, unharmed. Jenny had been stabbed 30 times in a classic depiction of rage-induced overkill. Her wounds were in the back, chest, arms, and throat. Most were inflicted after the mortal wounds, like after she was already dead. Jenny had a stab wound direct to her heart, just as Susan Armstrong did. So first, cops look at the husband because they had a not amicable separation, but he was at work with a ton of witnesses. She had no boyfriend at the time. Jenny didn't have time for a boyfriend. At the time of her murder, Jenny Ng was caring for her four children alone and looking after her elderly parents who lived in nearby Kew. So let's switch back to the Easy Street murders. The main suspects at the time were Barry Woodard, Susan's boyfriend, and the unnamed boyfriend who climbed through Sue's window, known in the press as the unknown salesman, and neighbour John Grant, the crime reporter. But what we haven't talked about is the unknown copper. A friend of Susan Armstrong's is a former police officer. Actually, to be more accurate, he is a disgraced former police officer. He'd been removed from duty permanently after sexually harassing motorists that he'd pulled over. Go, Victoria Police, you just rock sometimes. Now, some reports state that this unnamed copper was a former lover of Suzanne, and others say he was a friend. Anyway, after he had been booted from Victoria Police, his marriage crumbled and he became a heavy drinker. He was known to have blackouts. That's always great, right? He was also working as a labourer on a work site only a few streets away from the Easy Street address at the time of the murders. When interviewed by police, you know, his former colleagues, he gave two different accounts of his whereabouts on the night Sue and Suzanne were murdered. He doesn't appear to have been questioned again at all until it was raised by a reporter 20 years later. And now that reporter indicates that they believe police were covering up a fellow cop's crime. I don't know this individual cop, but I know plenty of other police. The one thing they hate more than a criminal who gets away with it is a dirty cop. Having said that, after innumerable investigations, Victoria Police undoubtedly had a problem with corruption this era and beyond. We all know the Golden State Killer was a former cop, right? One who got fired for breaking the rules. Just saying. Another report that was pieced together after the fact was at a local hospital. They had a man enter the ER with blood-covered hands and cuts on the night of the 10th of January. Nurses asked for his ID and he ran, which is probably an everyday occurrence in the ER. It wasn't until 3 days later when the story of Suzanne and Susan's murder, this was reported to police. He was described as a stocky, middle-aged man. So all of these suspects, apart from obviously the unknown person at the ER and the former police officer, have been eliminated with DNA testing. How compelling that testing is, I don't know. Some doubts have been thrown on the DNA collection and storage in this case. There was one vital piece of evidence, however, that was found at nearby Victoria Park railway station. It was a bloody butcher's knife. The knife was later proven to be the murder weapon on Easy Street case, which, to date, remains unsolved. There is a $1 million reward for information on the death of Susan Bartlett and Suzanne Armstrong. In the case of Julianne Garcia-Soleil, a tip-off a few years after her disappearance had police searching bushland and digging up a disused well. No further evidence has ever been found. Jenny Ng's case seems no closer to being solved than the others. There is also a $1 million reward for information in her case. And that is all I've got to say about this case. This week's palate cleanser is frankly even darker than the case I just talked to you about, but it's a total binge. Vanished, the Tara Calico investigation is a compelling, brilliantly told story that has more twists and turns. You will think that you are playing a game of Twister with a 10-year-old. Thank you all so much for being here and being with me for these 45 episodes. And I will see you all again next season. Until next time, sleep with one eye open and call the cops on all your dodgy neighbours. Hello again, it's me, Anne. Can I ask you a favour? If you liked this episode of Murderlade or any previous episodes, please take a moment to rate and review. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts or alternately, head on over to Facebook and rate the show at the Murderlade the Podcast page. Every rate and review helps other strange ones find us and join the family. Oh yeah, and I totally mean that in a creepy Manson family or the Aussie cult, the family kind of way. Thanks for listening.